Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description.
Corey, we've talked in the past about the fact that nobody really fits into a simple categorization. Like, you can't put people in a definitional box because people are complex. That said, as much as everyone wants to say that they're unique, there's always some sort of a category that someone can be assigned to in general. And if you look at the way people approach life, I can almost guarantee that whatever their approach is, it's not totally unique to them. It can at least be categorized along with others. In other words, everybody lives by some sort of philosophy. However, I'm curious from your viewpoint, Corey, how many people out there, what percentage of people do you think actually deliberately choose a philosophy and say, that's what I'm going to adhere to, that is the philosophy I want to live by?
I'm sure it's extraordinarily small, which is sad because I think even if people didn't necessarily choose and say, like you said, that specific philosophy is the one I'm going to learn about and decide to live by, I think everybody could do well or would be much better off just trying to learn a little bit about different philosophies. And that's one thing that's got me really excited about this series that we've been doing on different philosophies. Last time it was on nihilism. Today we're focusing on stoicism, is that I get to learn about them. And it kind of gets me excited to put into affect some of these awesome things that we're learning.
I agree. You know, there were things about nihilism as we studied that I want to adopt, that I really liked. There are other aspects of nihilism that I don't agree with. And obviously, we talked about how there are all different types of nihilists and nihilist approaches. You know, if nihilism is one category, there are so many subcategories and different ways that you can approach that general philosophy. But yeah, absolutely. People can benefit a lot from learning what other smart people have said about here's a good way to approach life. So these conversations are especially, I think, interesting and useful in the context of Collapse, because the philosophies that people adopt as Collapse progresses will determine how they respond to all the chaos. And I think that understanding the pros and the cons of all these different approaches can help us to solidify how we personally want to prepare mentally for what's going to come. And it's going to help us understand why other people do what they do as we see Collapse play out. So this feels like a really valuable way to spend our time as we're trying to get the full picture around Collapse and how we want to respond to Collapse and why other people respond the way they do to Collapse and how their philosophies and approaches to life accelerate Collapse or help us mitigate Collapse. There's so much here that's important for us to discuss.
Yeah, like you said, it's probably not very many people that actually look into these philosophies, decide to embrace them, and especially in like a Collapse mindset. But man, reading through, doing the research here, it really is so applicable. We talk about resilience and coping and finding ways to be okay with our current situation. And I really found in my study that Stoicism has a lot to offer in sort of being able to become resilient mentally. So I'm excited to dive in, kind of get into what is Stoicism. I think this is a great time to throw in the caveat that Kellen and I are not experts on the topic. Just like everything else we talk about on the podcast, it involves research on our side, and philosophy is so big. There are so many different ways in which something like Stoicism can be embraced. It's not going to be the same for everybody. The way that we're going to present it today may not accurately represent the way that I can guarantee that it won't be accurate to the way that everybody who embraces this philosophy does so. It's up for interpretation. You know, when we did our nihilism episode, we received a lot of good feedback, and we also received some feedback that was critical. And that's totally understandable. We actually had somebody write a whole open letter to us on one of the Collapse subreddits. And we appreciate that. And we want to call that out because we know, again, we're not going to hit every point. And I was telling Kellen, I would like to revisit these topics, each one of these one day, and hopefully be able to talk to people who are really invested in it, who view it as their philosophy of choice, and be able to gather their perspective and really find out why.
All right, so let's define what Stoicism really is. And it might be a little bit challenging simply because there are so many definitions. It seems like we face this anytime we get into a topic like this. It was the same thing with nihilism, right? That there were so many different approaches and definitions to nihilism. Even when we were looking at fascism, there were a lot of different claims as to what fascism really is. I think with Stoicism, one of the reasons it's challenging to define is because there's kind of ancient Stoicism and there is the modern take on Stoicism.
And there's even one in between there that's called Neo-Stoicism, which is still several hundred years old, but not as old as like ancient Greek Stoicism.
So I think we'll tease out some of those differences, but a couple main points about Stoicism, and feel free to chime in here, Corey. One of them is that your thoughts and your beliefs create the world that you inhabit. It's not your external circumstances, right? You can only control yourself. You can't control what happens around you. So you should take responsibility for your mind, right? That this happens to you or somebody says this to you or whatever, that can't make you feel a certain way. Really, your reality, your world is what you see and feel, and you get to have an impact on that. And so, at least from what I saw, so much of it has to do with your emotions, to the point that there are a lot of misunderstandings about what Stoicism really is. Like, there are some who say Stoicism means you just minimize your emotions or remove them entirely, while others are saying, no, it's not that. It's that you are maximizing positive emotions and reducing your negative emotions. While others are saying, no, it's a means of kind of choosing what we feel. We don't react to our circumstances. It's not about having no emotions, but instead it's a philosophy of having no useless emotions. Or another way I saw it stated was it's not a philosophy of not caring, but instead a philosophy of not caring about things that don't matter. So between all of that, the general consensus is you're deciding how you react. You're deciding what emotions you want to give attention to.
Yeah, I know some of the critiques of Stoicism, like you mentioned, is maybe there's this idea of a lack of compassion. Some people say, you know, because you're controlling your emotions to such a degree, you may not be able to express them or share them and empathize with people, which is interesting because actually a very large part of Stoicism is being engaged with other people. It's about doing good for others. And a lot of that involves compassion. So I think it's just misunderstandings and misconceptions of what it really means, especially because there's sort of this idea that a Stoic today, in the way that the English word sounds, it sounds like somebody who basically just suffers without complaint. And you think of someone as kind of being like, if they're Stoic, it's kind of grim and they're just a straight-faced, like take whatever comes their way, no emotion type of person. When Stoicism to the ancients in actual philosophy, yes, it is suffering without complaint, but there is so much more to it. So to expand a little more on one point you just made, basically this idea that we feel like, in general, people feel like events happen to us and then we react to those events. And what Stoicism does is it inserts something between those two. It's saying, no, you don't react to the events. You react to your thoughts and judgments and beliefs about what that event means. So what they're saying is, because you're reacting to your own thoughts about something, you have the ability to essentially control how you react. Society or our culture might have, you know, quote unquote, taught us to believe certain things about our circumstances and taught us that we should feel certain emotions. And so we do. But Stoicism teaches that actually you should look really inward at your beliefs, your judgments, and choose them carefully so that you can react more appropriately. And one way that Stoics do this, just to dive in as an example, is by comparing how we react to something in one situation and then react to it in a different situation. So you could think of like a soldier who is willing to go and die for his country, right, in battle, and will courageously go out in the battlefield and get terribly wounded, have a limb torn off or something terrible, right? And there's no complaint. And yet later he might get a cold and complain nonstop about how terrible being sick is, right? And it's like, okay, why are we able to withstand the pain on the one side but not the other? Well, perhaps it's because of the belief, the judgments that we have about why we were experiencing that pain that made it okay, where in the other instance, we weren't okay with it. And yet the amount of pain that we were feeling in the instance in which we were complaining was so much less. So just kind of giving yourself that level of control to say, I can react to this a certain way, and I'm choosing to do that. So it's a lot about attitude, facing your current circumstances and situations with the best of attitudes. And then going along with that, the next step is, like you mentioned, Kellen, limiting your concern to what's actionable. Because like you said, you're kind of choosing the important emotions. So much of our energy is spent worrying about things that are outside of our control. And so Stoicism basically teaches you should focus your time, your energy, your worry on the things that you have power to change, and anything else should be basically completely ignored. And this is one that I really felt drawn to, because I think without knowing what Stoicism was, I've kind of always had this mentality that there is no reason to worry about something we can't change. And even when we are afraid of something, so often the way we worry about it and the amount that we worry about it is worse than the actual event happening when it does. You know, we dread that dentist appointment that we have and getting that cavity filled, and we think about it and we have anxiety over it and we're dreading it. And all of that cumulatively is worse than the hour that we spend uncomfortable in the chair when it actually happens. So yeah, those two ideas are a little bit interchangeable. We have control to respond to our circumstances and the things that happen to us. And then we also have the choice to focus on the things that we can change and ignore the ones that we can't.
Yeah. And when you talk about that space between what happens to us externally and how we react internally, one example I found that I thought was interesting, this person said, when dealing with insults, pause and reflect on whether it's true. If it is true, there is no reason to be upset. It's not an insult to be told what is self-evident. On the other hand, if it's false, then equate the insult to that of a barking dog. When a dog barks, you make a mental note of it. However, can you actually derive any meaning from a dog barking? It would be foolish to let the bark upset you, to go through the rest of your day thinking, oh dear, does that dog like or dislike me? So that's just one example of, you know, this thing happens to you and you take a deliberate approach to how you think about it, and that will help you manage your emotions.
On kind of a side note, I don't think we'll talk about this much in this episode. Stoicism has a whole separate train of thought on giving credence to what other people say, and even the desire of having people's approval and why that's wrong, why we shouldn't seek for approval from other people at all. But yeah, we live in a world where so many people get offended, right? There's so much offense happening out there. And it's because society has taught us that if somebody wrongs us by saying something, you know, insulting us, we should take offense to that. And we should either hold a grudge or respond with contempt or whatever it is. But Stoicism is saying, you get to decide how what someone says to you, like if that matters or not. Do you care? Why do you care? You should really look inward to say, what effect does that person's thoughts or beliefs about me have on me? And I like that a lot, that idea of, is it true? Well, okay, then like either that's something you can improve on or it's not. Is it in your control or is it not, right? And then the next thing is, if it isn't true, who cares? Let it go.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think somebody who says, I'm a Stoic, or I adhere to Stoicism, and somebody who says, I'm a nihilist, the two would not feel like they're similar to one another. But while studying this, I feel like the two actually have a lot of similarities. In both cases, it's this deliberate approach to say, hey, here's the way things have been presented to me, or how I've always thought I should feel about something, or the meaning I should subscribe to. And yet I'm going to make a conscious decision on how I want to reconstruct how I think and feel about it. Or in the case of nihilism, what meaning I assign to it. And you've alluded to this already, Corey, but there are so many aspects of Stoicism that actually align really well to things you and I have talked about already on the podcast. When we talk about coping techniques and how to deal with collapse, you know, one Stoic practice that you can do is manufacturing adversity. And it's this idea that, like, when things are going really well, you can actually deliberately practice going through hard things. You know, Tim Ferriss is one of these kind of popular advocates of Stoicism, who has helped revitalize and modernize the philosophy. And he talks about practicing poverty, that sometimes even when you're not impoverished, it's good to spend some time eating nothing but rice and beans, or to rent out like a dingy motel, or only ride public transport or whatever. And that's something that we've talked about before. We've talked about how it's good to, even just when you have a mosquito bite, practicing how long you can go without scratching it, practice that self-control. You know, if you're a homeowner who has a lawn and you're mowing the lawn, maybe you don't use the Propel feature on your lawnmower. You try just pushing it. Like whatever it is, it's just these little ways to practice making things a little bit tougher for yourself. Another one is visualizing negativity, like kind of picturing worst case scenario. And that way you're prepared for it if it does happen. And if not, then you're pleasantly surprised. We've alluded to some of that before. You know, Stoics talk about things being grouped into kind of three main buckets. There's things that you have complete control over, things that you have partial control over, things that you have no control over. And when it comes to what kind of goals you set for yourself, the higher the degree of control you have over it, the more that thing is worthy of your attention. So again, we've talked about that before. Like let's focus on what's within our control. We can't prevent collapse necessarily, but we can do things to help prepare ourselves and our family members to maybe do our part in mitigating it.
Yeah, it's really cool to see the sort of modern applications of this and the recent sort of studies that have been done into it. I know there's something called cognitive behavioral therapy, which I didn't get the chance to do research on, but it gets its sort of core theories from Stoicism as well. And it's a legitimate theory and practice today for helping treat depression and anxiety. Again, I don't know a lot about it or how widespread and common its use is, but I do feel like, and it does go to show, especially with these examples that you've just given, that Stoicism can provide a lot of aid to us as we try and find ways to prepare for and cope with collapse.
Well, and there, as you mentioned, modern applications and all that value that we can find, especially as it relates to collapse. I think it is worth mentioning, you know, we haven't yet specifically called out where this all comes from. Stoic philosophy, this school of philosophy, comes from ancient Greece. And then later it was really widespread during the time of the Roman Empire. Usually the kind of ancient Stoics that get mentioned the most are like Seneca the Younger. Marcus Aurelius is one that you probably see more statements from him than anybody. Epictetus is another one. Not sure if I pronounced that correctly, but there are definitely some differences in ancient Stoicism and what we typically see preached as modern Stoicism. You know, the ancient Stoics tied Stoicism in with what we would consider perhaps more of a religious belief. There was a cosmology there. They believed that the universe is governed by providence, and even that the universe itself, in some sense, is a living being.
Idea of pantheism, right? That's what that's called.
Yeah, exactly. Another common belief that you'll see from ancient Stoics is that wealth and power are inherently distractions from virtue or the path of virtue. That's very different from what some preachers of Stoicism claim today. You know, Ryan Holiday is one of these really popular promoters of Stoicism. He's kind of branded it or marketed it as this like life hack. And he'll often point to billionaires and say, like, look at all these Stoic attitudes that billionaires display. And not always explicitly, but at least implicitly making the point that like, hey, if you adhere to Stoicism, you'll get rich.
And I will say I ran into some of my own study saying like, beware of that, you know, and this is more probably the purist saying like life hack Stoicism is Stoicism being abused for marketing purposes, basically.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Stoicism has been revived as this like really popular philosophy. It's even something you see a lot in places like Silicon Valley. And that's in large part because of these individuals we've mentioned, like Ryan Holiday and Tim Ferriss. They've helped with this resurgence, but unfortunately, in doing so, they've also kind of diluted it and maybe twisted it a bit. But that's not to say that everything about ancient Stoicism is better than modern Stoicism. I think there have been improvements over time. One idea that was perhaps more palatable in ancient times and something that we don't see as positively now is this idea of like noble suicide, which we don't need to dive into that, but it's just an idea that persisted at points during ancient times within the school of philosophy regarding Stoicism that I think we would look at in today's world, in modern times, and not be okay with. The other thing to note is that sometimes modern writers, authors, influencers, people trying to be heard, like to point back to like ancient Greek philosophers and claim that what they're saying comes from the ancients as a way to build credibility. But that's not always the case. Sometimes they're just kind of cherry picking certain statements that they like and saying, oh, well, Marcus Aurelius said this, so now it has all this credence, like this is this ancient truth. But because of that approach, there have been a lot of new ideas regarding Stoicism that have been inserted into the conversation that don't necessarily align with what a pure Stoic would say.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the differences between sort of ancient Stoicism, how it's changed and used today. All of my research was on the ancient side, and I actually read a book. This book is called The Practicing Stoic by someone named Ward Farnsworth. Really great. If you're interested in getting an introduction into Stoicism, I thought it was fabulous. But it talks about, I'm just going to go through some of these other core tenets. I'm not going to hit all of them, but just to get a little bit broader idea of what types of things Stoicism advocates beyond what we've already mentioned. So one of those is they hit really hard the idea of perspective and our perception of the world around us. We kind of already alluded to that in saying, you know, how we react to something is based on our perspective. And so they advocate for looking at things from different angles. Look at your current situation as someone would look at it from space. You know, take a 10,000 foot view of it, basically. What would someone who was in the other party in your circumstance, right? If you're having a conflict, for example, look at it from their perspective. They also advocate for looking at things from the perspective of time and the fact that time is infinite and our time here is such a small, insignificant blip. And therefore, the issue or problem that we're facing is likely very small and insignificant in the grand scheme of things as well. The same thing with space. You know, we are in infinite space. So basically, it's just this idea that as grand of a problem as you feel like you might be facing, your fear or your desire or certain outcomes to a certain circumstance, you can view them from these different perspectives to get a more real idea of the impact. They talk a lot about moderation and not being in the extremes of anything, to never be carried away by your desires or your pleasures. They talk about how it's okay to want, for example, wealth. They use the word prefer. It's a preference. I'd prefer to be wealthy, but my happiness is not tied to whether or not I'm wealthy. It's not tied to whether or not I have power. It's not tied to any desire. If we can keep our desires muted, then we can actually intensify our happiness. And it's kind of this interesting paradigm that we don't really think of often. I think in our sort of shallow world, we think of, I need to maximize my pleasure. I need to get all of my desires, and that's how I maximize my happiness. But in Stoicism, they talk about how you can actually find more happiness by appreciating the things that you do have and appreciating the fact that those things change. So that goes into another one, which is change. They're big on the idea that everything is always changing. We need to embrace that change. They use the word detachment. So the idea that we're going to essentially detach ourselves from what we have. And going back to the wealth example, they say, you know, if you're wealthy, it doesn't go against Stoic beliefs to be wealthy, but you have to be able to detach yourself from it. So they say, you know, go through the exercise of planning out what would happen if I lost all my wealth. How would that affect me? Would that impact me greatly? If so, then I'm not handling my wealth correctly. Like, I should be detached from it in a way that losing it would not shake me. And the same goes with any other thing that we have. And in a collapse situation, we're talking about, maybe we're talking about wealth, maybe we're not, maybe we're talking about other things. But being able to be prepared to let go of what we have, being extraordinarily grateful for the time that we do have it, viewing everything that we have as a gift, showing gratitude, but also being able to detach ourselves and being okay to part with those things. Another big part of this is how we handle fear, all of our emotions really, but especially a fear of death. And there was a whole chapter in the book that talks about death. I won't go into that deeply here, but I think that is an extremely helpful thing for collapse awareness as well, just recognizing that death happens to everybody. Death is happening to us every day in that we're getting closer to the end of our lives, they don't advocate just not having a fear of death, but they advocate basically making death your best friend. And this is kind of going back to your what you'd mentioned with the noble suicide, for example. In the ancient Stoicism, they took it so far as to say, you own death. Like, death could happen to you at any time, and you shouldn't fear it because it is going to happen to everybody at some point. But also keep in mind that no matter what happens to you in your life, you own the ultimate choice, the freedom of your own death. And that was a way for them to maintain control of their situation, saying, I can suffer anything until I view that the suffering is not worth it anymore, and I have the choice to end it, right? Not something that we advocate for here, obviously, but it is a tenet of that ancient Stoicism. But I do view this idea that they say if you can overcome your fear of death, you've basically found the ultimate happiness. That's the ultimate fear for most people. And if you can get to a point where you truly don't fear it, what else is there to fear? Again, this life that we live is a blip. Everything that we'll experience in it has been experienced before. We just need to enjoy our time here, enjoy what we have while we're in it. And when death does come, we can view that as an experience. They talk about some of these philosophers who documented that as they transitioned away from life, as they died, that they wanted to record and view what that journey was like. And they said, of course, none of them have ever come back to tell us. But I do hear so many people talk about collapse and say, we live in one of the most interesting times. We're living through, it's almost a privilege to be able to view what's happening in the world, something that most people will not have gotten to see. And so I think that this kind of goes hand in hand with that idea and just embracing every moment for what it is and what there is to learn from it.
And I love that idea of viewing the world with the lens of what I can control and what I can't control. And although, like you said, we're not advocates of anyone ending their life earlier than what happens to them naturally, just accepting that concept that, like, I'm in control here, that there's something empowering about that. And the way you mentioned wealth is viewed, the way that any sort of life experience, whether positive or negative, is viewed with the perspective of here's what I can control and here's what I can't, and I'm going to take responsibility and ownership for those things that I do control. I think there is a lot of power in that.
Yeah, in the end, it comes down to self-control. It's a very disciplinary sort of, like, you discipline yourself to think a certain way, to be a certain way, to control your, not just your emotions, but your reactions. You control your desires, your pleasures. They also have an interesting view on adversity. So I'm going to read right from the book here. It says, Stoics take a different view of adversity than is conventional. They don't seek out pain or hardship, but they seek a mindset that isn't thrown into disarray by those things and that is able to turn them to good. And to me, that basically just sounds like mental resilience. The whole idea of being able to not just bounce back when difficult things happen, but to not be thrown into disarray when they happen in the first place. And then taking that one step further, it says, and that is able to turn them to good. So actually using those tough situations and finding the good in them, or being able to use them to spread good to others. And then lastly here, and perhaps the most important tenet to Stoicism, is that of living a life of virtue, is what they call it. Reading from the book, it says, Stoicism also offers a strong affirmative vision of what life is for, the pursuit of virtue. Living virtuously means living by reason, and the Stoics regard reason as calling for honesty, kindness, humility, and devotion to the greater good. And hey, I think that's great, right? The idea being, with all of the other tenets that we've talked about, we should be striving to do good. And words like honesty, kindness, humility, devotion, they may sound idealistic, but when I think of resilience and when I think of community, when I think of what the world needs to be, or not the world, but what we need to make in our own world in order to make it through the tough times ahead or make it as far into them as we can, these are the types of things I want to get through it with. And these are the types of people that I want to be around in trying to do that.
So much about Stoicism seems valuable in the context of collapse. And it's clear that both you and I, Corey, like a lot of things about it. We've spoken highly of it. We've talked about the positives. But I think it's also worth mentioning some of the cons, the disadvantages, the negatives to Stoicism as a philosophy, especially in regards to collapse.
And I have to say, Kellen, I didn't do any research onto this side. I personally got really excited about Stoicism. Reading this book and doing the research, for me, it was like, okay, I want to learn more about this. So much of it resonated with either my current thoughts, or I said, okay, I'm not living that way, but man, I can see how that could really help. I want to learn how to do that. So I will be interested to hear the cons that you've laid out here, to take an honest look at them and say, okay, does that change maybe how I feel about this philosophy?
Great. Well, I've only got a few here. I'll let you decide which ones you think are valid or not. In my own opinion, a couple of them are more criticisms of Stoicism when it's not practiced the way that it really should be, but I think they're worth mentioning. So one thing that can be seen as both a positive and a negative is that you are not as strongly affected by the things that happen around you. So, of course, that's a good thing when it's negatives, but those who have practiced Stoicism for an extended period of time and have gotten used to not letting their circumstances affect them very much, some have said that earlier events that, you know, could really make you happy now don't trigger as much happiness. You don't feel as much excitement. It's like, yes, your lows are not as low, but your highs aren't as high either. Another aspect of that is that because you're not as affected by what's happening around you, your emotions aren't going one way or another quite as much as the average person, it makes it difficult for other people to read you. It can make it challenging for other people to understand what you're thinking or feeling or where you're coming from. In other words, it's harder to relate. And sometimes it's challenging for those who strongly adhere to Stoicism to feel like they can develop as strong of relationships because of that.
Hey, this one cuts deep as I kind of internalize that, because even though I am just recently learning about Stoicism, I recognize that it calls to me because in my own life, I'm already doing some of this stuff, and the muting of the highs and lows of emotion is something that I do already. And this is something that my wife and I have had conversations about. I don't get crazy excited about things that she might. I also don't get crazy sad about the things that she does. I don't show a lot of emotion. I don't cry. She makes fun of me because she says I'm a robot. She's probably seen me cry like 2 times in our 10 years together. And that is a source of frustration for her sometimes, because she doesn't necessarily know where I'm at emotionally. It's a safeguard that I feel I've put in place. Again, before learning about Stoicism, I felt this way, that it's a way for me to stay steady. So yeah, I'm grateful that I can stay steady in that way. But I do struggle sometimes to share in those emotions with her, especially when we're at the extremes.
And it's interesting you say that, because in my own marriage, I've had some of those same conversations.
Maybe it's just a thing about being a guy. Like, guys just don't maybe express emotions as much.
That's probably true. But I think I'm naturally more aligned with Stoicism than other philosophies. I typically am pretty even keeled. So people will describe me as being laid back, which is all good and great that I'm not going to freak out about something. But it also makes it so, like you said, there's not as relatable of an external emotional reaction as I could have.
It's funny because I think of other emotions like anger, and she tells me that she's never seen me angry before. And here I'm thinking, I've gotten angry at my children for not doing what I ask them to do, you know? And she's like, that's not anger. Like, yeah, you're showing annoyance or whatever. But she's like, I also just don't feel that I've ever seen you actually angry, which I feel grateful for, that I haven't shown that, because I don't want to be an angry person, you know? But yes, I can see how you said it's definitely a pro and a con, and where neither of us are necessarily people who are prone to showing the extremes of our emotions, it would be interesting to hear from someone who does, who is prone to those extremes, and see how they feel about it. Do they wish that they weren't? And maybe it's a grass is always greener sort of thing, but I think there will always be some gives and takes to both.
For sure. Well, the next con I want to mention actually kind of relates to a comment you made when I described that, hey, I also don't have all these outward emotions. You said, hey, maybe that's just part of being a guy.
You're going to say it's sexist, aren't you?
Well, sometimes Stoicism has been correlated with, or at least people point to it as, a form of toxic masculinity.
Oh, interesting.
Right. This whole idea of handle your emotions better, right? Telling my son, like, man up when he feels upset. Or, you know, toxic masculinity can be used to justify a lot of things. a lot of really awful things, kind of this whole idea of like boys will be boys. And so this idea of wanting to like control what's within your control goes hand in hand with needing to like aggressively compete and dominate whatever you can, which is obviously really problematic.
So just to clarify, because I'm a little confused on it, just as far as, is that to say that stoicism is aimed more at men, as if to say that women wouldn't embrace this as well? You know, you use the example of your son and telling your son to control his emotions more, but could we not just say the same thing to our daughters?
Yeah, I don't think stoicism is necessarily aimed one way or another, but I think there are these things built into our society, the way that we treat boys versus girls, the perception of what it means to be masculine, right? That macho mentality. Usually that macho mentality is like, don't complain, don't whine, don't cry, don't show vulnerability or sensitive emotions, which you can see that there's some level of overlap with stoicism.
Yeah.
Even though pure stoicism, it's not saying you can't feel all these emotions, but there is a tendency to say, hey, you have the control so that you don't need to show or express negative emotion. And then again, going back to what's within your control and what's not within your control, that can be really dangerous when it comes to like how men treat women. When society has unfairly shown a history of putting women in an inferior position, which is totally not justified, and yet you can see how what somebody sees as like a stoic male, like this strong, resilient personality, might not always be elevating others who they unfairly see as a lesser status, or at an extreme, to say, you human being are something that I am more powerful than. I have power to control you, and therefore I will control what's within my control. So all of that, as you can tell, is a very flawed way to approach it. It's awful. And yet it's been pointed out, at least as I'm doing research, that people sometimes feel that those who claim, I'm a stoic, I adhere to stoicism, are the same kind of people that you would label as displaying toxic masculinity.
And on that point, I think it's interesting to note that in this book I read, he talks specifically about the people who strive to embrace stoicism. And he basically says, I don't remember how he said it, but people who embrace stoicism don't say necessarily, I am a stoic, right? Like, for much of the reason I think that you just explained, stoicism is about humility. You know, being a student of stoicism means you're constantly trying to be better. You're trying to learn more how to apply the philosophies. At one point he says, basically, I'll actually just read the paragraph. It says, stoicism has been criticized for advocating a lack of feeling or compassion, for asking the impossible of its students, and because it is impossible, for making hypocrites out of those who claim to follow it. Basically saying that there's no such thing as achieving true stoicism. It's a never-ending journey. It says, perfect stoicism is no doubt impossible. The wise man, held up as an example by the Stoics, is best viewed as an ideal. It is meant to provide a direction rather than a destination. This shouldn't be alarming. Many philosophical and religious traditions call on their aspirants to work toward an ideal that nobody quite attains. The question is not whether anyone gets to the end, it's whether we are helped by trying. And then it goes on a little bit more to talk about how there are these claims of Stoic hypocrisy, which I think kind of goes along with what you're talking about here, people who claim to be Stoics but aren't living it. It says that usually arise from a misunderstanding of what Stoicism is for. Its purpose is to help those who use it, not to give them a basis for judgment of others. Explaining Stoicism and practicing Stoicism are different activities. So anyway, just kind of reminded me of that, that you're saying that like many times people who claim to be a Stoic and to have achieved it are probably toxic because they don't understand completely what it is. If they did, they'd understand that it's not achievable in the first place.
Yeah, and I love that you shared that part about it's not meant to have you judge others. If I decide that Stoicism is a philosophy that I want to really embrace, that doesn't give me the right to say this is the best philosophy that everyone should adhere to. And therefore, if you are not in line with Stoicism or you're not practicing it to the same degree, then that means you are lesser than I am. For example, anyone who knows me and my wife knows that she's better than me in just about every way, right? More talented, more intelligent. Like,
she's prettier.
Definitely prettier. She inspires me to be a better person. And it would be very unfair for me, going back to our previous conversation, to say, hey, she's more emotionally expressive. So therefore, look at me. I'm better at stoicism and I'm doing better at life.
I'm happier. I'm in better shape than she is because she's not a stoic.
Right. Being emotionally expressive, I think, is a good thing and is healthy. And I'm glad that that's how my wonderful wife is, right? So I think some of these issues here, these disadvantages of stoicism, are just examples of people twisting it or not really living it the way it was designed.
Yeah, and I liked, just to finalize the idea on the toxic masculinity, I like to hope that that's the case, right? That you can be a student of stoicism and not have a sexist bone in your body that, if done the right way, doesn't give off that vibe or create the conditions for that masculinity.
Yeah, I agree. So let me share what I think is actually the most valid criticism of stoicism, especially when it comes to collapse. And for this one, I'm actually going to read from a Quora post. I thought this was really well written, and I think it's a good point. This individual, as they were talking about stoicism, they said, "The biggest problem with stoicism is that it emphasizes dealing with problems rather than fixing them. In fact, stoicism's generally deterministic outlook on the world tends to actually discourage the idea of fixing problems. There are some problems that we really can't do anything other than cope with. With these problems, stoicism really can be useful and beneficial. There are many problems, though, that we can do things about. With these kind of problems, stoicism can not only be unhelpful, but sometimes even downright detrimental." And so it's just this idea that there are short-term benefits, not always long-term benefits of stoicism. You know, it's like if you're in poverty, then control what you think and feel about it to the point where you can be happy with what you have, which, being grateful and content, is good and noble, but not if it completely robs you of ambition to improve the situation. And so I look at something like climate change. And rightfully so, we talk about how so much of climate change is just outside of our control. Stoicism could cause somebody to say, like we talked about, I'm only going to control what's within my control, which for some, they might say, all I can control is what I think and feel about the situation. Stoicism is going to help me cope with the problem, but it's not actually going to inspire me to go fix the problem itself.
So let me push back on that a little bit, not to get into a whole debate here, but I'm curious because, I mean, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast. Can any individual make a change big enough to have any impact? And if not, how much time and energy should an individual put towards trying to solve the problem when that time or energy could be spent somewhere else on something that they can control, which maybe it's not preventing climate change, but preparing for it or adapting to it?
And I guess there's a lot of ethical implications there. It's hard for me to claim, hey, this is right or wrong. But one example I heard today, not even related to stoicism, but just in another setting, was that none of the pioneers of the women's rights movement, none of the founders of that movement, ever got to see the first woman vote. But it was because of their efforts, they laid this groundwork that allowed changes to be made later on. And maybe that comes back to different ways that you view stoicism. On one hand, you could claim, well, at least they were confident that they could control enough that it would actually make a difference. But if any one of those women would have just said, I can't create this outcome in my lifetime, which would have been true, therefore I'm not going to act. You can see the problems there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, even in the book, a very brief mention, it talked about ambition as being sort of a negative word. I remember it used that word and it was in a negative connotation. You know, maybe there's a low probability of success, but does that mean I shouldn't take that action if there's any chance, right? There are some people out there who would say there's a 0.01% chance that this works, but I'm going to go for it because we need it to happen, right? So I can totally see how, yeah, someone practicing stoicism might say 0.01% chance, I'm going to focus my efforts on something I can control and give up the opportunity to make that change. Well, if 10,000 people practicing stoicism were to say that, well, now the odds are that one of them would have been successful. So yeah, I do see that and understand that. Now, that being said, I also can see the stoic side of saying, yeah, maybe those 10,000, if 10,000 of them would have taken that 0.01% chance, one of them would have succeeded, and that would have could have made all the difference. But also, what difference could those 10,000 have made putting their energy somewhere else? They could have made a huge difference in a different arena. So I think it just, again, it's just another way of looking at things, but I think it is a valid critique of the philosophy for sure.
Yeah. So I think it's more, it's not necessarily saying, hey, don't practice Stoicism, but I think we need to be careful. I think a lot of it comes down to defining what you think is actually within your control. I can just make a blanket statement and say, I can't control what other people think or do, which to some degree that's true. But if I take that to an extreme, then I'm never going to try to help anyone change their behavior. I'm never going to try to convince corporations and governments and even my next door neighbor to be more careful about waste or resource usage or emissions or whatever. Whereas if I say, I can control this message that I'm going to deliver, and I can have an impact on them, right? Here's something, again, going back to those three buckets, maybe it's not totally within my control, but it's partially within my control, then that's still worth me giving my time to. Anyways, you get the idea. It's just something to be cautious of.
Absolutely. And we're probably getting far, you know, deep enough into the philosophy beyond the scope of our understanding. And someone out there who's studied this for a long time might have answers to that dilemma, but we don't. And I do think that is a valid criticism. So to end, I wanted to read something. This was a post on the R Stoicism subreddit, not the R Collapse subreddit. It was on Stoicism. I went there to look around a little bit and specifically searched for conversations around collapse. And I found this really interesting question that somebody posed. I'm just going to read the post. So they said, I'm unsure of how to word this. There's so much on my mind right now. I fear that I'm falling into the trap of apathy. I fear that society will collapse in the near future. People appear to be too reliant on technology and emotion, byproducts of consumerism, capitalism, the list goes on. And what doesn't help is that I don't have a complete grasp of this philosophy. Am I potentially losing my way? Do I need to seek professional help? I don't know if there's something wrong with me or something wrong with the world at large. It could potentially even be both. Do I simply accept the issue and love it for what it is? And then should I cease criticizing our society and focus on my own virtue? I'm probably answering my own question with these, but they are genuine questions. Was the human mind simply not made for this sort of information? What do I do to prevent a toll being taken on my mental state because of the current state of the world? And here was the top response. I thought it was really insightful. They say, if you believe society is near collapse, rather than focus on yourself, remember that no human being can live and thrive alone. We're a pro-social species that evolved to solve problems together. Ask yourself what you can do to help, but detach yourself from the ultimate outcome of your efforts. So there's that detachment word. Whether you succeed or fail is ultimately indifferent to the effort you put in and your intent for doing so. So this goes back to that idea that, real quick, as far as a confidence of what we can control, he's basically saying here, you can control what you do, but you have to detach yourself from the consequences, from the results of your efforts. You can't anchor your happiness to the fact to whether or not you succeed. Continuing, it says, if you do your best, help dozens or hundreds of thousands of lives along the way, but society collapses, was it really a failure? Society has collapsed before and will collapse again. That's just a fact. If it's in our lifetime, so be it. That is a cycle that has persisted for millennia. Focus on your part in making the world a better place for everyone to live in, and if society collapses, keep on doing it anyway. We are not civil because of civilization. We don't need society to be social. Virtue is within us. It isn't reliant on anything else.
Oh, I like that last part. That was poetic.
Yeah, really cool. And that kind of comes down to one of my core beliefs about collapse. And I think what is going to get me as far into it as I can possibly go is just this idea to help others, to try and do some good. Society is going to collapse anyway. I am going to die anyway. We're all going to die anyway. But if I view it that there is no failure, it's just more about what good can I do and who can I help, then that's enough. You know, you think about life and the world, whether society collapses or it doesn't, we live, we do some things while we're here, we die. So it's just about what is it that we're going to do while we're here. And collapse will involve suffering, which involves more opportunity to do good.
And I would hope for anyone listening, as you hear things about nihilism that you like, as you hear things about stoicism that you like, any of the isms, any of the philosophies that are out there for how to approach life, I hope the one thing that you would never let any of those philosophies rob you of is that will to do good, to make a positive impact. And that might look different for you than it does for me. But definitely when I find a philosophy like this one that seems to promote that, even though I feel like I'm pulling bits and pieces from everything I like from all these different philosophies, I'm definitely going to lean most heavily toward the one that's going to encourage me to be a good person during my time here.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.